Hi, welcome to Booktopia Podcast. I'm Andrew Kadenak, and I'm so happy to be joined by one of Australia's favourite authors, 29 books deep, Roland Perry. Roland, is that right? 29
books?
Yeah,
29, 30 just done and dusted, so I've got the 3-0, but it won't be published till next year.
Incredible. And so we're talking about your fourth novel, I believe,
The Honourable Assassin. That's right, correct, fourth fiction.
Yep. So fourth fiction, what I want to know is, 29 books, this is your fourth novel, How have you written such a bright thriller? Because it feels like it was written by someone, by a very talented thriller writer who's just been working and poring over this. You're delivering a book a year. I mean, how are you doing this? How are you keeping this story fresh?
Yeah, well, fiction is such a different business than non-fiction. And I had I started in fiction, book called Program for a Puppet, 1979. 5,000 published, 4,000 sold in England. They didn't even let the author know he could buy some remaindered books. However, it took off in paperback. When I couldn't write, and I'm not being falsely modest here, I couldn't write. Most writers don't have a beat on it. I'm talking about professionals who have a life with it, till about book four, and that happened to me. You talk to Le Carre, anyone who's really made it in a big way professionally, and it's four books. Before you got a voice, before you got the confidence.
Mm.
So the fiction got me off the ground, and then I did a couple more, one which was successful commercially, the other one was not such a big, I always make excuses by saying that it was criticised well, good reviews, but it didn't sell. So you got to face that. That was 25 years ago, and I've had a really good run of non-fiction, but in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, you've got to work that muscle again.
Yeah,
you got to have another crack and enjoy it. So I'd been travelling backwards and forward through Thailand and Vietnam, Burma, and places on four or five other books to do with World War II. You were talking about the Changi Brownlow to me, the book I wrote about the Burma Thai Railway. So I'm travelling all over this region and bubbling away in the background is you've got to have a thriller. You've got to get something out of it.
Mm.
So that's really wanting to have a crack, to work the muscle. A lot of experience with non-fiction can rub off to a point. Research goes without saying, it shouldn't show in fiction, it should not show. 40 Ways to Pick a Lock should not be the way, it should be through the characters and the narrative.
Yep.
However, you've got to know the subject material, and by travelling so much through the area and getting to know Thailand and Burma, and particularly those two countries, and Vietnam too, comes into the story a bit in Burma, Cambodia, you get a good grounding over several years, as it's been. And what I wanted was an outstanding, ripping female character and a pretty interesting male character. And the epiphany on the female came in Thailand. I was really thinking of the wonderful characterization in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Mm-hmm.
Having read that, I said, right, that's your standard. Get there at least, or don't bother. Now, how do you do that? You don't plagiarize, you don't copy. What do you do? How's it going to be completely different, but is outstanding? And that was the challenge, and that's a good thing to have in your mind as a writer. What standard of writing or characterization, what difference do I want to present? So I went for that and I found it, I'm pretty sure, I'm hopeful anyway, it's up to readers then. The male character, the other lead in the story, if you like, a lot based on my own nearly half a century in journalism and writing books and travelling around and dealing with intelligence agencies everywhere as research and resource material, right? Freddie Forsyth came out recently and admitted he'd worked for MI6. MI6 approached me in the 1970s. I said no. The reason they want someone like me or Forsyth is we know how to get into countries. We've got the writers, journalists to get through passport control. Whereas spies, one spy, a very, very, very senior spy at MI6 said to me one day, I really envy you. And I said, well, I said, you can go into Moscow, you can go to St. Petersburg or Leningrad, as it was then, and you can get information and you can go around. We can't do it. We spend our life watching the Soviets and the Russians. And he was serious.
Wow.
So they use people like me if they suborn them into being spies. And Freddie did it. I didn't. I think it shows in our writing, to be frank, without going any further than that. I think you compromise too much when you do that.
Yep.
And I'm interested in the writing and the character development as well. So that is part of the main character in this book. He's an investigative journalist. He knows how to get across borders. He knows how to look after himself. And in a diluted version, I'm the main character, but not other parts of it, which we won't discuss. We'll give away the story. But you use your own experience where you can. That's obvious.
Yeah.
Whereas, say, John Grisham has all those legal cases he can go and draw on. Roland Perry has to go out and do heavy yards for a year or so sometimes, you know, because you just haven't got the specialty in that area.
Yeah.
With Thailand and with this story in the background and the porous drug situation, in other words, the movement of drugs in Thailand and Australia, the borders, how they get across the borders, the big cartels, the Mexicans moving in, both here and in Thailand. That's the research background which I did, and everything I have in the book talking about those cartels and drug runners and the big business is happening.
Yeah, it is.
That's background, but it's happening.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the fascinating parts. The novels that I'm really drawn to, and particularly thrillers, are things that, like you said, you don't want to show everything, you don't want to over-explain, but it is fascinating what's going on, and the links with, as you said in the book, the links with Thailand and the Mexican drug cartels. I mean, it's macabre to say, but it's fascinating when you're reading about it.
Well, a little fact that I bring into the book, but again, it's not, you don't sit there reading, if you sit there reading a fiction going, gee, the research is great, then it's failed.
Yep,
it's like looking or watching a good movie.
Yeah,
you know, this is interesting, but you've got to be absorbed into it. But a little fact that you just, on passing, springs to mind, 500,000 cocaine users in Australia.
Mm.
In Australia, you go, wow, I know we're an affluent middle class.
Yeah.
And you think of, you know, the age group is apparently 25 to 50, and they're great. I don't use it myself. I don't touch any of those things. But I'm not making judgment of those who do. I'm just saying it is phenomenal that it's that big. And why do the Mexicans and others want to ship stuff here?
Mm.
Do you know why?
Why?
We pay 10 times as much as the Americans. So those Mexicans are shipping over from right across the Pacific, getting in on our great big fantastic border. Remember, we're bigger than China in land mass, and then we've got this magnificent coastline, and they're getting the drugs into our country illegally, and because we're, you know, it's a simple market exercise. If we can get 10 times as much, the freight, which your company knows a lot about, the freight is worth it. It's worth the freight. That's a literal explanation of it. It's worth getting them into our market.
Yeah.
I pay 10 times as much on the street for methamphetamine, coke, and all the other major drugs. Heroin, of course, is slipping away at the moment, but same thing. Thailand, because it's manufactured and developed in some of the Burma regions, and they get it across into Thailand. I know for a fact there are factories in Burma, illegal factories, producing methamphetamine. Oddly enough, just to get into it in terms of, I touch on this again, it's not the story, it's not non-fiction, but they send the ingredients for methamphetamine across to Burma, they manufacture it and then sell it back into Thailand. So it's quite complicated, but following that trail in the book, you're still following the main character.
Yeah, and I think that's the key of the book as well, is for all the research you've done, and it shows, but in the way that you want it to show, not as if you're just doing it, but the characters are fantastic, they really are. What I want to know is, and really one of the characters in the book is Thailand itself.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And what's drawn you to Thailand with...
Well, it's interesting. It's a mysterious country. That's not a cliche. It is mysterious. There are certain things that hem you in Thailand. I mean, the laissez majeste law, that you can't comment on the king, but there's another little adjunct to that. All their functionaries, in other words, the government.
Yep.
So if you criticise the government, you can end up in the clink.
Yep.
So there's a mystery in itself. You're confining the country.
Yep.
And for the average tourist, it doesn't matter. They're not going to come into Thailand. They're idiots getting themselves drunk and doing stupid things, which is a great slab of our younger male community.
Of course.
We know that.
Yep.
But in general, people wouldn't even know that that was the case. There was this laissez majeste, it's called L-E-S-E majeste.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of it. The fact that the king is a mysterious figure. He's been on the throne for, you know, nearly 70 years, longer than Queen Elizabeth. He came into power in 18 when his brother was shot in the same household as him. He didn't do it, I'm convinced of that, but no one knows how it actually happened. And he took over, and he's been involved happily with running the country ever since. He's the figurehead, but he's most revered, you know, he's a very revered figure. So there's a mystery there too. Not much detail is known about the royals in that sense, and they're put on pedestals. It's a different environment. The Buddhism is another factor which makes the place intriguing. I find that intriguing. So you roll it all up, and the exotic side of it, the erotic side of it, the third sex, which the book deals with in some way, because you just cannot go to Thailand, married, single, whatever, and not see this phenomenal where there are a million Ladyboys, for example.
Yep.
So
yep.
What's in the water there?
Yeah.
I don't try and explain it. It's not an analysis, but they're part of the story. They have to be.
Yeah.
So you cannot get away. And some of them are absolutely drop-dead stunning creatures as well. I could tell you many funny anecdotes about them, but I won't regale you with them here. I mean, I nearly made a mistake in one bar when I was meeting someone. But anyway, that aside, it is part of the mystery of the place. Why in Thailand are there a million transgender? Why? It's the only country in the world that has that phenomenal amount of people in that area. Look, a lot of it, they're drawn into poverty because it's a sex industry.
Yeah.
A lot of them aren't. A lot of them just have the transgender... They have the best surgeons, by the way.
Well, yeah.
Australian rules here, they have the best ankle and knee surgeons. Over there, it's other parts of the anatomy. And that's because there's so much of it going on.
Yep.
And but it's one of the mysteries as well. So it's a whole confluence of events there that makes it an intriguing country.
Yeah, it is. And an incredibly intriguing book. So I want to know, not so much the research part of it, but... you've written so much non-fiction, and obviously it seems like you constantly, through the years, will have a fiction book in the back of your mind or you're trying to flush out. I mean, what's not necessarily the research process, but the writing process, how does that change?
That's a good question, and I think through that myself often. In fiction, you've got to footnote and get everything absolutely accurate. The integrity has got to be there. It's got to be the same in fiction. So the difference with fiction is... it should be between the lines. You should know the author really knows his onions on this country and this particular thing.
Yep.
That's a key. For example, Le Carre, get it away from Roland Berry for the moment, Le Carre captured the whole Cold War era. I don't think in one of his spy books, maybe some listener out there can put me wrong, but it'd be very, very unlikely and very rare, does he describe the inside of MI6? I've been inside MI6.
Mm.
And if I was writing a book of non-fiction or fiction, I'd probably go for the description. You know, Le Carre knows what it's like. He was a spy. He was in the Foreign Office.
Yep.
So the key with fiction is to have such a command of the characters and the narrative and the story as such and the geography and everything that the reader doesn't have to be told. He knows that, or she knows that the writer is right on top of the subject material. That's fiction. Whereas non-fiction, you've got to show it through the non-fiction. You know the detail of the subject.
Yep.
Dialogue is interesting in that you learn quite a bit from biography, actually. I've done more biography than anyone in the country, as it turns out.
Yeah.
So it's just a fact, not a boast. It just happens, it's a strange profession being a biography, a bit of a voyeur in a way.
Yeah, that could be a whole different podcast right there, yeah.
And I end up hating a couple of subjects. You don't write that way, but I have hated a couple of them. Oh, one in particular, but I was well into the book and couldn't pull out of it. But you learn... I learned a lot about the biography and character of individuals by writing non-fiction biography. And you learn a bit about dialogue, which helps you transfer. You've still got to work on that within fiction. But for example, keeping it tight. When you write a biography, you don't go into too much detail on what was said. You pick the eyes out of a letter or a conversation or a tape. Don't make it up, of course. That's a big no-no for non-fiction, unless you're doing a dramatised non-fiction, different thing, but a proper... Say the Monash biography I did, you would not, or the Fifth Man on one of the Cambridge Ring. You don't make up. You have to have source for every quote. But you learn the economy of what quotes you use, because people that are reading non-fiction don't want detailed conversation. They want tight. Whereas fiction, you've got to give a bit more through the characters. So you learn economy, then you've got to learn to dramatise that. So there are certain things. They've both fed off each other for me, because non-fiction, fiction, you've got to move the story along. I think automatically now I'll top a chapter. I don't have to think if I really made that interesting and moving to the next chapter. Almost automatically after 30 books, your brain says, come on, finish on a note here and then move into the next chapter or move on. With fiction, having started in fiction, it transfers beautifully to the non-fiction because I had a strong narrative in my head.
Yeah.
Because I was trained in fiction.
Yeah.
It's not a genius on my part. It's just you're trained that way with a couple of fiction books and then you go, right, this will make the narrative easier. That's why I'm readable, per se, quote unquote, compared to other non-fiction academics, for example, who don't know how to do that, not interested in doing it necessarily.
Yeah, no, you're right. And it does, we were speaking earlier about, and we don't want to go off the subject, but one of the things we were talking about is also that you have you've written, I want to say, three feature scripts as well. Is
I've
that
written
right?
three, been commissioned and paid, which is nice to know.
That's nice. Yeah, and documentaries
and
as well.
Yeah, I've made 30 documentaries.
Yeah,
so I've made 30 docs. That was useful in the sense that before I ever wrote a book, I had script writing in my brain, not drama, although I did have to dramatise some of the documentary and have people dramatise sections of the documentary. They weren't drama as such, but it did have a part of my brain was trained over 5 years living by it in England to write scripts and to think visually. This is the key. The rule of thumb for most filmmakers, keep the book writers away from the script. They think descriptively. There's a long history of this. I mentioned Le Carre before. He's the only one that's actually written honestly of the big names about how difficult it is for a really good writer of books to transfer to the screen. They want to give you description. Go and see Bridge of Spies. You can see the storyboarding. It's brilliant. There's hardly any dialogue.
Yep.
The main character says, will it help? When someone says, will you, you know, aren't you worried? He said, will it help? Well, what a line.
Yeah.
Will it help? Three words, and that gives you the scene in a way. It's brilliantly done.
Yeah.
You can see where Spielberg's at his very best storyboarding. Well, that needs a screenwriter, not a descriptive writer.
Yeah.
And by the same token, scriptwriters can't write books. It's very rare they turn around and bother because it takes too long anyway.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
they
yeah,
can
yeah.
make their money in 3 or 4 months. They don't want to spend 5 years on a bloody book. You know, so it's those things, and I had that in my brain, so I am able to turn back to it. Still got to work the muscle.
Yeah.
I haven't done enough of it, but I'm competent and confident about tackling it when it's within my scope. I mean, I wouldn't do a Bond movie. It just would be, I couldn't cope with all the jangling machinery. There's no room for real character development. They're great, I saw the last one, fine. But I wouldn't bother because the script writing goes out the window and it's all special effects and stunts and so forth. Whereas if you ask me about would I like to do Bridge of Spies, I'd say I'd love to have a crack at it.
Yeah.
Because it's an era I know. So you've got to, in my case, confine it to areas you think you know about, you know, you think you want to have a crack at. So I will work that muscle again more, but I'm so keen on getting the books done that I don't sometimes make the time. It's a matter of making it.
Yeah, well, of course. Look, Roland, we could speak for hours because it's fascinating and your career is
Let's do that.
It's incredible.
You're a busy boy.
Yeah, look, you've got people to talk about this book to as well. Thank you so much for coming in, The Honourable Assassin.
Great.
It's one of the best thrillers of the year, undoubtedly. But it's just opened a key, and all I want to do is if anybody's interested in any of that world, if you've seen films like Sicario or any sort of film that sort of skirts around the borders of cartels. That's fine, but if you want something that's really heavily character-driven, as well as all those things, this is just a fantastic story.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Can I just say, and my computer guy said, don't forget to say latecut.net, which is my website.
Oh, yep.
It's
okay.
No paywall, it's just maybe more information on this story coming up. I've got an article that I'm just waiting to see whether it's politically correct enough. and that'll be up, but it'll lead to my other books. So latecut.net. And it was latecut in the cricket, one word.
Latecut.net.
Yeah, or latecut being edit. Well,
yeah, nice. Very good. Yeah. Very good. Roland, thank you so
thank
much
you,
again
Andrew.
For coming in. And remember at home, you can get The Honourable Assassin from booktopia.com.au right now. Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.